This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League knockouts begin. Kylian Mbappe's injury time brilliance saves us from a 0-0 only because there's no away goals between PSG and Real Madrid. Messi misses a penalty. Is he bad at them? Would Real have gone all out if the rules were different, or are they just not who they used to be? Meanwhile, Manchester City blows Sporting away. 4-0 at halftime is always 5-0 at full-time, but a couple of wonderful goals from Sterling and Bernardo as their relentlessness just gets more relentless. A game of two halves in the bonus Premier League game at Old Trafford. Brighton should have led at the break before Ronaldo and Fernandes take Manchester United into fourth. Also today, more on Qatar, upsetting former referees, and an apology to Bristol Rovers fans. All that, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Jim says, given Barry's lack of pod and radio appearances over the past couple of weeks, has Max taken to calling him directly on Zoom to ask non-questions like, Jared Bowen's quite good, isn't he? Hello, Barry.
Hello, Max. Good to be back.
Welcome back. You've been sorely missed by between three and four people, it seems.
I saw that, yeah. To be clear, I didn't have a breakdown. I haven't been cancelled and I wasn't ill. I just had a holiday due.
Marvellous stuff. You didn't go to India and paint any animals, did you?
No, that's a mistake I'll only make once. And I avoided cancellation for that.
Just. Good man. Mark Langdon from The Racing Post, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Bonjour, ça va, Philippe Auclair.
Ça va très bien, Max. Bonjour à toi.
And joining us from a Parisian hotel, my second bonjour, ça va, to Sid Lowe. Bonjour, ça va.
Bonjour, ça va.
All right, then. Let's start then with PSG.
Yeah, that's about as far as my French goes as well.
Yeah. Où est le gars? C'est loin? Ce n'est pas loin.
Voilà, le gars. Vous descendez le plus vite du gel du goal, puis tenez à droite et c'est tout droit.
Okay, it's better than mine. PSG 1, Real Madrid 0. As you said, Sid, that last-minute goal, that really messes up a match report, doesn't it?
Oh, what a bastard, honestly. let's look at it from a match report point of view. I was obviously at that point thinking to myself, this is Madrid in Europe all over. That it doesn't matter what you do to them. Somehow they're still standing. Somehow they find a way through. And then, of course, Mbappe found a way through and ruined it all. But it was a pretty poor performance from Madrid, except, of course, that defensively they resisted really quite well.
The goal, Philippe, was utterly delightful, wasn't it?
Yes, it was quite astonishing. And you can imagine what the reception has been in France for that. And the headlines today, it's not about PSG, it's not about Real Madrid, it's only about Kylian Mbappe. I think probably one of his absolute best. Did you notice, by the way, that when he scored it, he didn't celebrate in his kind of trademarked, copyrighted Kylian Mbappe way, but he just went mad. He just went mad, which shows what it meant to him. And he'd been the most dangerous throughout the game for PSG anyway, but he is, I was going to say, Sid was saying it was Real all over. Well, it was PSG all over. They were good. They were much better than they've been. In this competition and many times. But they won because of the brilliance of one of their players, who again has been Kylian Mbappe, 22nd goal of the season and so forth. And what can you say? It was glorious. I think it's the tempo actually at which he took that. So that the continuity of the movement makes it particularly pleasing in the eye. Unfortunately, it goes between Courtois' legs. That's the only thing that really slightly, if it had bent round, then kissed the post and gone in, it would have been almost the perfect Kylian Mbappe goal.
I'm quite interested in that. You think the fact that it's a nutmeg makes it less good?
Because I think there is a slight deflection as well.
Right, fair enough. Okay. One of the things that I thought, I was thinking about watching it back this morning, I must admit it didn't occur to me last night in the kind of in the moment and the speed of everything happening. But this is a player who I think quite often has been likened to Ronaldo, to the original Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo. And that goal last night, which I hadn't appreciated at the time, but of him going between two players was very much like that Ronaldo Valencia goal, the one when in 96, 97 when he was at Barcelona. And just that combination of the smoothness of the movement with the power that goes with it. And it's the fact that he sort of... He kind of it was almost like he was skiing, and that he sort of glided to the left and then back to the right again, and sort of through the posts almost. And he was brilliant all night. There was a couple of times last night when he picked the ball up. And there was one that he picked the ball up on the edge of his own penalty area, the top left corner of his own penalty area. And he got away from a first challenge at that point. And the pitch opened in front of him. And you could sense everyone in the stadium thinking, go on then, here we go. And it, in the end, obviously, it didn't come to anything. But just that kind of anticipation that went with it. Obviously, you know, he was involved in almost all of the good things that they did. The penalty, which felt to me like the penalty committed by a desperate defender who had reached the point where he didn't know what to do anymore. It's like, I just get to him, just stop him somehow. And of course, that's what led to it. And he was fantastic. One of the things, Philippe, you'll know this far better, which is why I asked you. He comes across, for a superstar in a team full of superstars, he comes across as totally different to the others. There doesn't seem to be the same, I don't know, self-importance or arrogance or cockiness about him that there is with others. You get the feeling that you'd actually quite like him, which I'm not sure you'd necessarily feel with some of the other ones.
Yeah, I think one major difference is not just his upbringing, but in the widest possible sense. It's, for example, you know, that Neymar Senior, there was a project Neymar from very early on with a young boy, but the project was all about sponsorship and making as much money as possible. And making him, of course, a great football player. I don't disagree with that. When Mbappé's parents set about, when they realized that they had a player, a young boy, who was going to become a super player, which, by the way, scouts were aware of when he was about 12, they were starting already to talk about him as the future superstar. They literally have done his education in such a way that he would have all the arsenal, so to speak, at his disposal to deal with what was going to come his way in his own way, not without having to rely on agents, advisors, consultants, and so forth, which is why, for example, you heard him speak Spanish yesterday.
Yep.
It's not bad,
very,
is it?
Very good Spanish.
Pretty
as well.
Impressive. And his English is absolutely spotless. His French would actually put a few French teachers to shame. His attitude as well, as you say, he comes across as very humble. He's a tough guy. You know, if he has got something that bothers him, he will tell you about it. But he doesn't have this. He doesn't have to prove to others that he's this great macho superstar. No, he's just the best, and he knows it.
Which is good news for Real Madrid, presumably, eventually. Not in this leg or in this game, but you presume, yes, Sid?
Max, that's one of the things that's, I think, been so interesting about the reaction to this. And maybe this is inevitable. There's a Spanish phrase which basically runs, whoever finds no consolation, it's because they don't want to. In other words, you know, there's always something that you can cling on to. And it's unusual to see so many Real Madrid fans so absolutely delighted with having been beaten in the 94th minute. Because in a way, this is like, well, we were knocked out, but hey, this is the guy that's coming to us next year and look how good he is. And there is this sort of slightly perverse joy in yesterday's defeat and a real sense of expectation and excitement about the fact, okay, look, he might win it this year with Paris Saint-Germain and we might not win the European Cup this year. But I tell you what, if he's coming to us, we will at some point because he was so good.
Barry, what did you... I mean, a lot of people were tweeting yesterday, social media going mad about the away goals law, and this is ultimate proof that the away goals rule was the best rule in the history of football. What did you make? I mean, the game wasn't fascinating, was it? Maybe they're right.
I'm not a fan of the away goals rule, and I'm glad it's gone. I did notice, I think it was Miguel Delaney wrote an article earlier this week. He seems to be more of a fan of it than me. Jonathan Wilson hates it. You know, you could pick individual or isolated games to make a case for it, for away goals and against away goals. I think PSG were vastly superior last night, probably should have won by more. I was quite unimpressed by Real's performance, and I don't think they would have been markedly improved if there were away goals still in play in this tie.
I think Benzema didn't look fit. I mean, he kind of played and was risked, and I understand why he was risked. But when you look at his kind of touches, him, Vinicius, and Asensio had 30-odd each. I mean, you know, they were completely out of the game. I suppose one reason for that, I thought, was that Verratti just dominated the midfield and was an absolute joy. But, I think there were reasons outside of the away goal rule sort of disappearing that meant that Real Madrid were not kind of as good as they could be.
Just on the away goal, it feels to me like, at the moment, I don't know whether I'm in favour of it or against it. It feels to me like this is something we will see the impact of this as this competition goes on. And there is a bit of me that thinks that I suspect that what looks like a good idea, we might end up thinking it wasn't such a good idea, getting rid of it. And in terms of the context specifically of this game, we are now in a position where actually Real Madrid's position is not as bad as it probably should be after last night's result. Because, of course, they go to the Bernabeu now, one goal, and it's done. And there isn't that double threat, or not double threat, you know, that extra threat of a Paris Saint-Germain goal. I think, but we'll see, I think we might miss the jeopardy. The fact that the away goal rule meant you could be in the second leg with it leaping immediately from win to defeat rather than passing through draw on route, if you see what I mean. And I think that means that Real Madrid are in a much stronger position than they would have been without this. Not necessarily in terms of how they approach the first leg, but in terms of how the second leg might now play out. And, you know, Real Madrid are actually not out, and they really should be, because of the way it was last night, they really should have been. And so that's where I see the balance of the away goals is how the second leg plays out. What it does mean, of course, is it now means, I think, although again, we'll see if this is actually played out, that playing the second leg at home now really has become an advantage, when I'm not sure it was before.
And I think as well, Max, like, if with the away goals rule, City winning 5-0 at Sporting, if away goals rule was in play, you'd say that tie is almost certainly over now.
Whereas as it is, it's finally poised.
It's on a knife edge.
Although Mark Pugacz was doing Australian telly with me, and he sort of made a reasonably interesting point, which is because it was...
Oh, that's faint praise. Mark would be delighted that
actually, he said, yeah. I'll take it back. He made a very interesting point.
We weren't really interested in.
I take it back. Puga's made a brilliant point, and he's a sensational broadcaster. He said, I'm already in trouble with Keith Hackett. We'll get to it. I don't want to get in trouble with Mark Pugacz. He sort of said, had it still been 0-0 with 15 minutes left, PSG might have shut up shop a bit, because 0-0 is not bad at home. But as it was, it meant they could just carry on attacking. So that is a possibility. So Philippe, you wanted to come in, Philippe.
No, not necessarily on this, because I do think it's very much a Marmite question, and also I agree with Sid. It was an experimentation to bring them in. It was to address a problem, which was the dearth of goals scored by teams, going on other people's grounds. So I think just wait and see for this one. But I wanted to go back to Sid, because before the game, if you saw that you had a midfield of Paredes, Danilo and Verratti against the midfield of Casemiro, Kroos and Modric, you would not necessarily have thought that the Parisian midfield would completely asphyxiate, dominate the Madrid midfield. Now, the fact Verratti had a game, he was the man of the match for me in terms of how he ran. I mean, Mbappé's in the dimension of his own in some ways, but Verratti was the one who made everything happen for PSG. He's an exceptional player. And I was wondering if in Madrid, they were wondering if that, okay, we're going to get Kylian, but what about Marco? Couldn't we do with a Marco?
Well, Madrid are in this position in which, and this, I guess, is an illustration of the fact that nothing is ever entirely linear. So Madrid are in this position where the transition to a, if you like, a post-Modric and Kroos era was kind of underway with Fede Valverde and with the signing of Camavinga. But what happened, and I think this is one of the things that whenever you talk about transition plans or succession plans, whatever you want to call them, one of the problems is that players' performances don't always fall into place at exactly the time you think they're going to. So you have this transition plan, and 18 months ago, you'd have said, right, it really does look like the end for Modric now. But then Modric starts playing brilliantly again, and Kroos starts playing really, really well again. And obviously Kroos is not as old as Modric, so you would expect that. And so this kind of transitional succession plan gets kind of put on hold a little bit, because the reality is when everyone's fit, you play Casemiro, Kroos and Modric, because they are the three best. Even if you think at some point we've got to bring Fede Valverde in, we've got to bring Camavinga in. And of course, this is one of the reasons why Martin Ødegaard ended up leaving, because theoretically his place was being built for him. And then all of a sudden, it's like, hang on a minute, this Modric guy's still quite good. What's going on? And so you can't always do it at the time that you want. So while they might look at Verratti and say, this is a player we need, and I think there is an awareness of if you like, rejuvenating that midfield, there is also a fundamental thing, which is every time they take a step back, they go, yeah, but these three are still the best when they're at the best. And yesterday they weren't. I suppose just to add to that, I don't know how it felt watching it on the telly, but certainly in the stadium, when obviously you've got a broad view of it, I felt that control of the midfield was also not just about those three. It was about the fact that you had Angel Di Maria, who seemed to be absolutely everywhere. I'm not sure he was always that great with the ball, but physically he was extraordinary. And then you had Messi playing in the middle with them as well. And so it was almost five against three, because they really did just kind of drop in and keep the ball. And that was one of the things that I thought was interesting about Messi's performance, certainly in the first half, is that, you know, that idea of running the midfield, I thought, was as much about him as anyone else.
Mark, can we talk about Messi and penalties? Because it seems strange that the greatest player of all time isn't very good at them. But is it the case that he isn't very good at them?
No, I think his record is sort of normal, which is about he's got near 80% of success rate. Is it in the high 70s? So he is an average penalty taker, and it's about the only thing that Messi is average at. Given the way that he transcends football in just about every other department, he's just a normal penalty taker. Messi does get the grabbed the attention there because he missed a penalty, but Courtois just looked absolutely huge in the goal.
You knew he'd save it, didn't you? Sitting there going, he'll save this.
You did feel, it feels like after timing to sort of say that now, that you felt he'd save it, but he just filled the goal. And he's got to be one, if not the hardest goalkeeper to be, one of the hardest goalkeepers to beat in those situations. But I think Philippe has found something that Messi's actually got a record for, Philippe.
Yeah, he actually established a new record last night. A record he was sharing with Cristiano Ronaldo, of all people, which is the highest number of penalties missed in competitive matches. They were equal on 29 until last night. And now Lionel is ahead of Cristiano by one. 30-29 is the latest scoreline.
And fantastic. That's another brilliant debate to have that's not at all tiresome between...
these are stats which I think are from 2000 onwards. I very much doubt there have been players, I tried to look a little bit at it, players before then who have had careers as long as those two, with this amount of responsibility put on them from the penalty spot. And I think that it might actually be an all-time record.
Think of all those players feeling smug about being better than Messi.
Yeah.
Graham Alexander, Julian Dix.
Pressman.
Kevin Pressman, 100%.
Kevin Pressman, fantastic. Kevin Pressman is officially the best player in the world.
Well, the greatest penalty of all time.
Yeah,
Kevin Pressman was never given the option of playing in the 10 for Barcelona for a decade. He could have done it.
And he saved more penalties than Leo Messi.
You're absolutely right, Barry. Before we let you go, Sid, how are Adama Traore and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang settling in at Barca?
Well, Adama Traore has played really, really well the two games that he's played. Aubameyang has come not as fit. He played, I think it was 29 minutes or 21 minutes against Atletico, and he must have played around about 25, 30 minutes at the weekend. Didn't really do very much in either of those games, but as I say, comes from... When was the last time he played? It was November, wasn't it, I think, or early December. And he doesn't look fully fit yet, but Adama Traore has been amazing. I must admit, I'm not someone who's watched a lot of Adama Traore until he came into the Spain squad. And I kind of kept feeling like this is a guy who needs the pitch to be twice as long. He kept running out of space, and the final delivery wasn't always good. But his final delivery has been really, really good in these two games that he's played. He's put a lot of good crosses in. He seems to understand the mechanics of the way that they play. And also, he's just quite a lot of fun to watch, isn't he? And at the weekend, it was like watching Jonah Loma at the weekend. Like, the opposition players were just bouncing off him. They just couldn't stop him. There was a moment, most of the time he stayed out really wide, right out on the touchline. But there was one moment when he picked the ball up and he kind of ran it through the middle of the pitch and across. And it really was like watching an athlete run around with a load of kids trying to chase him. And they couldn't get anywhere near him. So he's produced two assists in his two games and started very well.
Beautiful. Thanks, Sid. You may go home now.
Thank you.
That's my pleasure. Au revoir, Sid Lowe there in Paris on his way back to Madrid. That'll do for part one. Part two, we will discuss Manchester City's cagey approach to that game in Lisbon. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Sporting Lisbon 0, Manchester City 5. Man City, the first team in Champions League history to lead an away game by more than four goals at halftime in the knockout stages of the competition. I'd written, did the away goals rule change mean that City were a little bit more negative than usual? But we've already done that joke twice now. So you beat me to it, Barry. They were so good in that first half, Baz, weren't they?
You sort of run out of superlatives for City. We know how good they can be. That was them at their best. I think Sporting were perhaps a little overawed by the occasion. It was their first knockout game in the Champions League for 13 years. But I was hugely impressed with City's patience, their kind of relentlessness. You see, even when they're 5-0 up, players still chasing down opposition, you know, opponents, trying to harry them off the ball. And, you know, City have this goal they score over and over and over again, where they get the ball to the byline, pull it back, and someone, you know, slots it home. Now, that's just, it seems quite an easy thing to do, but it's impossible to defend against nearly. And City seem to have a monopoly on scoring that goal repeatedly, and no one can do anything about it. But some brilliant performances. The manner in which City's players keep themselves motivated is impressive. I suppose helped by the fact that Pep Guardiola is constantly urging them on, even late in the game when they're 5-0 up away from home and the tie is over. I suppose they all know that if there's any slight dip in performance, there's at least one or two fellas ready waiting in the wings to take their place. So they have to keep playing for Pep.
And I guess, Mark, Sporting are a team, from what I understand, that always go for it. It's a bit like Leeds, I guess. You know, they're the ideal team that City want to play, because they're not going to change how they play when they come up against them.
Yeah, and I think from Sporting's point of view, you know, they would have felt, you know, to stand a chance in that tie, they need City to lack efficiency in the final third, and they were absolutely ruthless in the final third, and there's not much you can do about it, as Barry was saying. I mean, they only had six shots on target and they scored five goals, and, you know, some of the goals, the Bernardo Silva half volley, which I think we can call an official half volley, and Raheem Sterling's curler, just, you know, brilliant. And then also, as Barry said there, you know, the players they bring on, like Gundogan came on and then just started doing these wild dummies in the middle of the pitch that you just can't, you know, what can you do about that? But from Sporting's point of view, you know, I still think it's been a good campaign. They've reached the last 16. The manager, Amorim, was laughing on the touchline towards the end because I think he realised what they were up against. And I do wonder, for a team like Sporting, how brilliant it was that they reached the last 16 of the Champions League. Then you run into Manchester City and go out. Like, are you almost better finishing third, playing in the Europa League and really having at your kind of level, I suppose, maybe more at something your level, and maybe have a chance of winning the competition? I suppose the glory of the Champions League means that even the last 16 feels a little bit more important. But I think had they been in the Europa League, which, like I say, I think probably where their kind of level is, they would have been decent runners to maybe go a long way. They just ran up into one of City's best performances of the season, really. They were just fantastic.
Which Bernardo Silva was not entirely happy with. It's extraordinary. And he said, well, we sometimes played, I mean, nil-nils, and we played better football than this, which is a very Guardiolian thing to say, because, you know, we all remember Pep, you know, at times praising his team after it had been beaten, for example, saying, well, actually, that was one of our greatest performances. And they were terrific. This said, I'm a little bit... Another little atom of me died last night because it shouldn't happen that the team that won the league in the sixth ranked country in Europe should lose at home in such a dramatic fashion and could actually have conceded even more than that. Now, when you look at it a bit more closely, it's obvious that there are reasons for that. I think that Sporting's wage package is about a tenth of that of Manchester City's. So there is a chasm here. It's not a gulf, it's a chasm. So, and you do wonder, yes, in a way, it would not be better if they were playing in the Europa League. I mean, apart from the fact, I think they will make quite a lot of money for being in the round of 16 from UEFA. You have to think about that. And their sponsors will have been very happy about getting there. But there is this imbalance is really, really, is a problem, is a major problem.
I'm worried, Philippe, you know, given all the issues in football, how many atoms of you have died? And are there enough atoms left? Because I like a world with a Philippe Auclair in it.
Maybe I have to think of myself as a kind of nuclear power when I can still produce. Actually, no, I don't produce atoms. I produce energy. So maybe, yeah, one day I'll be spent.
One day you'll explode. You'll explode.
Philippe. We know explode that. Live on the pod.
There'll be a mushroom cloud. It'll just be there going something. FIFA have finally done something, and his ears starts burning. We'll hear the air raid signs, and then suddenly we'll all have to get undercover, and that was it. And then the bongs of the news at 10 will go, and then George Alagaya will say Philippe Auclair has exploded. Barry, can we just talk a little bit more about Bernardo Silva's goal? Because the technique to strike a ball like that when the ball's coming from so high is just absolutely delightful.
Yeah, I think the technical term for what he spanked it home, spanked it past the keeper. It's just glorious, a glorious goal. I've heard debate over which one was better, his or Raheem Sterling's. They're both fantastic goals, but Bernardo Silva's for me all day long, Clive. And the keeper, Antonio Adana, he actually got a hand to it, I think, but could only sort of tip it onto the cross. Well, he didn't tip it. It rifled off his fingertips onto the crossbar and in, which always makes it better when it hits the woodwork and bounces down. But yeah, I think we can conclude Bernardo Silva is quite a good player, and it's always quite amusing to think. There was a point during the summer, I think, when it looked like he was going to be surplus to requirements and move on. And considering how ridiculously good he's been this season, that would have been an awful mistake on City's part to let him go.
For him and Sterling, right? I mean, like, there were rumours about Sterling as well. And they're sort of the two best players for City this season, perhaps in a list of probably someone else that I've forgotten about is having an amazing season. But they're both brilliant at the moment.
Yeah, and yet, looking at how good they are, I still found myself wondering during the game, how are they going to mess up the Champions League this season? what way will they find to not win it, despite clearly being the best football team in Europe?
I thought Barry was going to go, he was wondering if they could do with a Harry Kane up front. We haven't had that argument for a little while.
It's hard to see past Liverpool, City and Bayern for this, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what you think, Mark. I don't know if there's anybody...
The only other team, I'd chuck Chelsea in there as well. They haven't played quite as well in the first half of this season. I think there have been some mitigating circumstances. They've had a lot of injuries to deal with. But they showed last season that the competition is kind of made for their type of football. And even when they went to the Etihad earlier on in the season and lost, there was that Lukaku one-on-one that he missed. If he scores that, maybe people are talking again how Tuchel has managed to get one over Pep Guardiola. So I think in sort of fine margins, I think it's the two other English teams. I don't think Manchester United I would put in that bracket, but the two other English teams and Bayern, who are a wild team, capable of scoring 4, 5, 6 goals. But then, as we saw at the weekend, also just as sort of vulnerable defensively. And I think when they come up against a really top team, they could struggle. I would fear for that Bayern defence, I think, against what City do going forward. I'd probably make City favourites against Bayern.
Yeah, for those of you who don't watch any of the Bundesliga, search out the Bochum right back's goal in that win over Bayern. It was absolutely extraordinary, like a lovely move, and then it was a proper spanked goal, Barry. It was absolutely perfect, and the ball stayed ball, and everything about it was wonderful. On to some exciting another moment for an atom or two to fall from the body of Philippe Auclair. Mackie says, what does Philippe make of today's announcement that UEFA are partnering with Socios?
Socios.com, yeah.
Yeah, it's the fan tokens. What does it mean for fans? So they've partnered with, UEFA have partnered with Socios, selling fan tokens as a means of supporters getting access to, quote, VIP trips to UEFA's season kickoff events, the chance to visit UEFA's HQ. I can't see why anybody would want to, it's an office. I don't even go to an office for a virtual meet and greets with UEFA legends. Is that like a, that's a Zoom with, you know, it's a Zoom with Fabio Cannavaro or something. Philippe, your thoughts?
Yes, I mean, it's not an atom. I think it was a whole molecule disappeared, a puff of smoke and was gone. This being said, nothing that I wasn't expecting, or because this the sudden gold rush for the money coming from crypto technology and crypto companies is something that is one of the major problems facing football at the moment. But the fact UEFA is teaming up with Socios.com is extremely worrying indeed. I mean, we won't redo the debate about crypto that we had the other day, even though I think we should redo it at some point, because things have changed. They're going ever further.
Because me and Barry still don't understand a word of it, I think.
I've read several articles on it, loosely participated in a pod special on it. I still have no idea what any of it is or means or how it works. Not a clue.
The so-called fan engagement, it's all about monetization of fans' loyalties. It's all about that. But it is also presented as a kind of trade, a trading platform. And you can only get these tokens when you acquire the cryptocurrency that goes with those tokens, which is called Chilis in the case of Socios.com. So in fact, you're asking the fans to basically give their money, their dollars, their euros, their sterling, whatever, to actually support a cryptocurrency, which has lost a lot in value, by the way, since it was launched, which has got really, the tokens themselves are totally worthless. They are worthless. You look at the way they're rated.
Not if you want to see the accounts department at UEFA.
No, absolutely. No, but the fact is that the whole thing is presented as a means to bring fans within the game, give them more control, a greater, better experience. When this is actually, you're taking things away from them to be able to sell them to them. I mean, some of the experiences that they sell is just laughable. And what do? You support an architecture of a crypto architecture that doesn't give a monkeys about rewarding the fans.
Does it give a bored monkeys about the fans?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. They don't give a bored ape about it. And the fact that Socios.com is, of all the platform engagements, perhaps the most credible, tells you a lot about this industry. It's shocking. I mean, it's absolutely shocking. And the fact is there is no consultation. The fact that what these clubs are proposing, I mean, are things that fans should have access to freely. These people hate what they call legacy fans. They absolutely hate them. They hate season ticket holders. They hate people who have so much emotional investment in their club's history and colours that they think that somehow they own it. And in my heart and mind, for me, they own it. I own my club. You own Cambridge United, whatever. We are the owners. These people hate this idea. They want to take it away from you so they can sell it to you again. But sell it to you by propping cryptocurrencies, by propping companies, which could be a little bit more transparent, shall we say, certainly far, far better regulated. And that's the path we're taking at the moment, which explains as well the reaction of fans forums to this announcement has been extremely strong, to say the least. I don't know if you've seen the statement from Fans Europe, but I think it said all there was to be said in something like 6 or 7 lines. And I think we should, you know, perhaps at some point revisit that. And by all means, Mr. Alexandre Dreyfus, CEO of Socios.com, if you are listening to this podcast and, as per usual, are thinking that we're all just FUDs and boomers who are against new technologies, well, come on here and we'll have a good chat about it.
Well, you mentioned Alexandre Dreyfus. He says he's the CEO of Socios.com. Quote, this groundbreaking partnership is a result of UEFA and Socios.com's shared commitment to embracing innovation and technology to enhance the fan experience in sport. Thanks to this new alliance, hundreds of millions of fans around the world will have the opportunity to become more than spectators and play active roles in the biggest club football competitions on the planet through fan tokens. Dreyfus says that fan tokens enable clubs to better interact with the digital aspects of their fan base. The value is that is provided is not financial, will never be financial, he told Sky News last month. The value is about the experience and the connection that it's provided between the fan and the club. Then producer Joel writes, direct listeners to our crypto special. As Barry and I said, that may or may not help you to understand things in greater detail. We'll be back in a second where we'll be live from Old Trafford. Well, not live, but we'll talk about what happened there. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United 2, Brighton 0. Mark, a game of two halves this, wasn't it?
Oh, it absolutely was. I mean, Brighton just dominated virtually every area, really, in that first half. And I think at half-time, fear for Manchester United is the wrong word because, you know, it's always quite funny when they struggle. But yeah, it looked bad for them. And I think the way that they came back in the second half, and I know that the goals Brighton contributed to the first one and then also the red card, but there was still pressure involved in sort of turning over the ball in a dangerous area. I mean, it was really important for Manchester United. There's so much noise going on at the moment at the club, from, you know, some very serious stuff to, you know, some comedy bits about sort of, you know, what maybe the players are calling the assistant coaches and the Ted Lasso and all of this. So they absolutely needed to win. And in the second half, I felt they responded well. And you know, Cristiano Ronaldo was desperate for his goal. And then there was a few nervous moments in those last 10 minutes. Welbeck had a header. It wasn't an easy chance, but it's still an opportunity. And there was the cross that hit the bar. And you know, you did wonder if Manchester United would find another way to not win a football match, having had sort of 50-odd shots, wasn't it, against Middlesbrough and Burnley, and not won either of those two. So probably wasn't as good a performance, say, as the Middlesbrough one, or maybe even sort of the first half at Burnley, but that they've managed to beat a very awkward opponent and three, you know, massive points, really, because if they finish outside of the top four, I think it is going to make it difficult for them in terms of who the next manager is and just everything around the club. So, you know, they really do need to finish in the top four, and this was a vital victory.
Barry, I wonder if Ronaldo could simultaneously be the problem and Manchester United's player of the year by the end of the season.
I see where you're coming from with that question. I'm definitely in the camp that thinks he's the problem. He has obviously ended his goal drought, and it's unlikely he'll go that long without scoring again. But, you know, I still very much see him as one of many symptoms of many problems Manchester United have. But on the field and off, I think his ego is a massive issue. But, you know, it was a good goal. I was impressed. There seemed to be no backlift. I had to watch it several times. When exactly did he get that shot off? Or, you know, did it take a deflection or anything? But will he be their player of the year? I mean, it's going to be a low bar when it comes to that particular poll. So who knows?
Maybe. I mean, David Hay is in with a shout, which is...
Oh, definitely. His save from Jakob Mulder was in the first half was just outstanding.
Yeah. I thought Philippe Bruno Fernandes' goal was, it reminded me slightly of that Glenn Hoddle goal v Oxford. Not as beautiful, but in the way that dummy did sit the defender and the keeper down was really...
You should be talking about it, Max, because obviously it had... At the moment, I felt very differently when I saw that. I thought, oh, he's going to score. And this is going to actually make people forget the last 10 minutes of that game, which were honestly embarrassing, really embarrassing. And it was rather marvelous. But more to the point, I'm wondering, you know, this fact that at home, you're being bossed by the 10 players of Brighton in the last 15 minutes, when you're ahead and you just hang on to it and you score this 2-0, so it looks okay. But it was not a 2-0 victory, to be honest. Is this going to be the moment when they finally, the bored ape goes off their back? Or is it going to be revisited in other games? That's my question. Can it be seen at the moment? Well, this time, actually, we held on. We didn't give away a lead. We got the 3 points. But is this something we're going to see in every single Manchester United game throughout the season? Is that we're not very good at managing games at all? I don't know. It felt really odd. No?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know is the answer. I mean, I agree that they're not a very good football team. And the Rangnick situation, because I think we were all very, you know, we're all football hipsters here, aren't we? We're all very much Rangnick. This seems like a very sensible thing that Manchester United have done. And it's much more fun when Manchester United don't do sensible things. But it still turns out, Mark, that this sensible thing hasn't worked out very well, or they haven't really thought it through, or it doesn't, or because he's just interim, he just doesn't have the authority. And therefore, the players don't have to listen to him.
Yeah, I think that the authority point is the one really where the players know, and you know they're already briefing about they'd prefer Pochettino maybe to be the next manager. I mean, who is doing that? I mean, you know, none of them players really should be thinking that they'll be there next season, given the way that they've been performing for the last few years. So I think there is a lack of authority there. I suppose in terms of the midfield, I think McTominay and Fred get really criticised and maybe over-criticised. I don't think they're any worse than some of the other players, you know, that play for Manchester United, really. But they can't control a game very well. And so that does that does leave them vulnerable, I think, in those moments. And there is also a lack of confidence. You see it in Harry Maguire, for sure. You know, he's struggling desperately at the moment with his game. Jadon Sancho, you felt like maybe he was turning a corner, but then I'm not sure that he has, really. And so there's a general, I just think, lack of confidence. And I do wonder if that this win, that they really needed, can just give them a springboard onto, if, you know, not great things, but just better things for the rest of the season. But they are a team that just still looks vulnerable. If you put crosses in against them, you can move the centre-backs around or you know, without too much difficulty. And I still think that they're going to sort of struggle to finish in the top four. And they've got a really interesting Champions League tie coming up against an Atletico Madrid team that's nothing like the Atletico Madrid that we've seen of recent years. So it's not a lost cause, really, that last 16 tie, really, even how bad they've played. And that gives them an opportunity maybe to really save their season over the next few weeks. But they can't play like they did in the first half and expect to win too many matches, I don't think.
Barry, I'm loath to talk about any refereeing decisions, but I just wonder if that Lewis Dunk red, if he was slightly unlucky. Webster's coming round. It felt like I was surprised that the ref was sent to the monitor.
Yeah, it was your fellow countryman Jared Gillette was on VAR, I think. I thought it was a marginal decision, and if I had been Peter Banks, I wouldn't have upgraded the yellow to a red. And the reason I wouldn't have is because when he blew for the foul, he was immediately surrounded by Bruno Fernandes, Harry Maguire, Scott McTominay, Luke Shaw, Cristiano Ronaldo, Jadon Sancho and Anthony Elanga, all harassing and badgering him to give a red. And for that reason alone, because it was despicable behaviour by Manchester United's players. We've seen it before from a different generation of United players, that famous picture of all the skinheads surrounding, I can't remember who the referee was. But for that reason alone, if I had been Banks, I wouldn't have upgraded it because I wouldn't tolerate that sort of behaviour from so many obnoxious players.
Could send off Lewis Dunk and then send off all of them. I mean, I know that would have meant the game was abandoned.
I think he gave Bruno Fernandes a yellow, but I'd have been flashing the yellow around a lot more.
Do you know what's interesting? They always sort of do a token one, but they absolutely, you're right, completely within his rights to book every single one of them. And like then it would stop, you know. But then had he booked all of them, that would have been a strange thing for a referee to do, and that's dangerous when referees do things.
It would have been a surprise, Max.
It would have been a surprise. We don't like surprises. We'll get onto that in a second. Philippe, you wanted to update us on the Abdullah Ibaze case. This is to do with the Qatar World Cup. We have mentioned him on the show before. He's a former media manager within Qatar's World Cup organising committee, which is called the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy. He's currently in jail in Qatar, serving a 3-year jail sentence for bribery.
Yes, I mean, what is new? I don't know if it is new, but there is, I think, probably the best presentation of the case has been made just yesterday by Nick McGeehan of the Fair Square organisation. And there's been a lot of confusion about what exactly had happened and the role of the Qatari Supreme Committee in that. And so what Nick McGeehan did is that he simply looked at the evidence that we had that was available at the moment. And I think a very important thing he showed and he proved was that the investigation into what Abdullah Ibaïs did or didn't do was instigated by the Supreme Committee because a member of Qatari's ruling family called the superior of Abdullah Ibaïs and said he had evidence that people had conspired to exclude that person from a social media contract. And so they requested intervention of the Supreme Committee in that matter. And therefore, this is how the whole thing was set into motion. And then how he was arrested, how he was, he says, coerced into making a confession, how there were these this trial and then this appeal trial at which he wasn't present, where no evidence was actually produced. And basically the case itself is, I think it's the clearest explanation of what is seriously wrong with this, and the fact that the Supreme Committee haven't been necessarily completely straightforward in their explanations, and that it also shows that other football actors, such as FIFA, for example, should perhaps have intervened in that and should perhaps still intervened into this issue. And if it's possible, Max, to actually direct our listeners to what Nick McGeehan has written on this, because I think it's by far the clearest explanation of this case and the reason why so many of us, I think, are genuinely worried for what is going to happen to the father of two young children who has been sent to jail for 3 years and after what honestly looks like a grossly unfair trial. So can we put a little link to this story in our pod?
Sure, yeah, or we can tweet it out. Absolutely. Human Rights Watch and Fair Square, whom the author of the piece, Nick McGeehan, is a director of, first wrote to FIFA on the 4th of October, noting that Ibaïs believes it was his internal criticism of the Supreme Committee's handling of a strike by migrant workers in August 2019 that led to his prosecution and conviction. That is disputed by the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy. In a statement last month, it said Abdullah Ibaïs's claim that he was targeted for taking a position on a labour-related matter is a fabrication and a lie. The allegations presented by Ibaïs have no credibility. The case against him is rooted in evidence of alleged manipulation and misuse of state funds and has absolutely nothing to do with personal opinions or actions on labour-related matters. A FIFA spokesperson told The Guardian the letter from Fair Square was acknowledged and a reply sent on the 19th of November saying that efforts aimed at ensuring Mr. Ibaïs receives a fair trial are ongoing and that FIFA has taken note of their recommendations in that respect. Please also note that FIFA has said any person deserves a trial that is fair and where due process is observed and respected. In the case of Mr. Ibaïs, we will continue to follow this matter closely. Bob says, reaction from Barry on why Sunderland have been at best deliberately vague to fans and everyone else about who actually owns the football club, and also thoughts on which team named after a racecourse they'll lose to next, please. Bob is a Newcastle fan. I don't know how close you've been following this, Baz.
Not as closely as I probably should have. It emerged yesterday that Kirill Louis-Dreyfus, who everyone thought was the majority owner of Sunderland, isn't the majority owner of Sunderland, and that Stuart Donald, Charlie Methven, and their South American pal, whose name escapes me at the moment, actually have a majority. But Kirill Dreyfus insists that he makes the decisions, but, you know, now that's been cast into doubt. Newcastle fans must be just loving what's going on in the Northeast at the moment, because they're on an upward trajectory. Results are starting to go their way. Performances are improving. They've PIF has got another 80 billion injected into it earlier this week, and Sunderland are just completely gone off the rails and are a total basket case club at the moment. So I suppose watch this space.
Louis Dreyfus said in a statement, "As previously stated, I have executive control of the running of the football club, something that was a fundamental requirement upon the purchase of my shares, and the executive management team report directly into me on a day-to-day basis. Over the past 12 months, Sunderland's required significant shareholder funding as part of our ongoing investment within the club, and as a result of the lasting financial changes from the pandemic, substantial investment will continue to be required moving forward to ensure we fulfil our collective objectives and all shareholders remain wholly committed to honouring their respective financial obligations." Friend of the pod, Barca Jim, says, "Who's the panel's favourite retired referee?" Craig says, "How many ex-referees have the pod's panel upset this week?" Neil says, "Why did you break Keith Hackett?" For those of you who don't listen to me on the radio or don't see on social media, I was talking about Martinelli's red card, right, for Arsenal, where Michael Oliver gave two yellow cards quite quickly. And I'd noticed that on TalkSport, Martin Keown was disagreeing with it and Darren Bent disagreed with it and then Keith Hackett disagreed with it. So I said, you know, it surprised me that they all did when it seemed like a pretty obvious red card to me. And Keith Hackett had said, when he was managing the referees, he would say, "No surprises, lads." And I think my flippant response was, if a player ran on with a chair and hit another player on the head with a chair, that would both be a surprise and a red card offence. And anyway, Keith Hackett got very upset and has now refused to ever speak to that radio station again. And I've tried to reach out, and I thought it was quite a polite response, saying, "I didn't mean to upset anybody. And here's my, you know, I followed you. Give me a call whenever, we'll exchange numbers. If you want to come on the show, I'll pay you out of my own pocket." But he has told me the damage has been done. And that is it. And it's very strange if you ask, you know, 10-year-old me, when I was watching Keith Hackett run around refereeing games, that he would be forever furious with me. In a world of forgiveness, it seems very strange. But maybe I am the clickbait broadcaster I never thought I was, Barry.
Well, I think Mr. Hackett's beef is that he was asked on to TalkSport late at night to offer his opinion on this contentious decision, which I happen to think isn't particularly contentious at all, wasn't offered a fee and did so out of the goodness of his heart. So to see you flippantly make light of his contribution the next day or a couple of days later, that's what irked him. I can kind of see his point, but I've seen the clip in question. I listened to it live, and you were quite clearly, you know, it was a lighthearted jab. It's not like you absolutely slammed his opinion.
The main thing is, Max, and you were standing up and supporting referees in the face of, you know, unfair criticism from pundits, and you know, there's not enough of that really, and so I think it was completely ridiculous. Really, I mean, I appreciate that you don't want to sort of make the situation worse, but I mean, it was way over the top. Keith Hackett's reaction to, like I say, you actually doing the right thing in supporting an under fire referee that had done very little wrong and was getting just criticism that was completely undeserved.
I just want to say one more thing on the Keith Hackett gate, which is, of all the people, like, you know, TalkSport is, I really love working there, and you know, it's got lots of different presenters who perform in different ways. But of all the people who have given stick and all the people who've been like dug out and picked on that radio station, for me to be the person to finally break someone into refusing to speak to them again feels really unfair. Like, there are other people who are much more provocative than me. I'm like the nice person. I'm like the nice, just trying to have a nice day person. And there I am. I'm the one that I found the one person who would be broken with a gentle comment on what they'd said.
You've really taken this badly, haven't you, Max?
Yes, because I don't like upsetting people. Anyway, speaking of which, we were talking about Graham Souness's comments on Kurt Zouma, and specifically the part, not when he said the cat did nothing wrong, but the bit where he said, you know, these West Ham fans are salt of the earth, East End of London, they won't like this, which led me to suggest that perhaps other fans, I don't know, Bristol Rovers fans, were totally happy with that sort of behaviour, to which this email comes in from Joe in Bristol, who says, Hello, Max and co. First time emailing into the pod. I just wanted to pick up on Max's comment of expecting cat violence from Bristol Rovers fans ahead of the more salt of the earth West Ham faithful. I'm not a Bristol Rovers fan, but I do happen to live on the same road as the MEM that they play. Although they can often be a bit of a nuisance and leave the odd beer can lying around, I would like to note that in the 3 years I've lived here, I have not once seen an act of animal cruelty by them. There are many happy cats on this road. I did once catch one of them trying to steal a football from my back garden once, but I wouldn't want to tarnish them all as ball thieves. All the best, Joe. Thank you, Joe. And look, before my apologies to just everybody, but like, I appreciated your email. I enjoyed it. And that'll do for today's podcast. Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
We'll be back tomorrow for more Champions League. This episode, oh, there's a new thing, Barry, that's come in that you may have heard it, that we now have to credit the off-air people as if they matter to this whole thing.
American thing, isn't it? At the end of American podcasts, you have to thank lots of people.
Would you like to do it today?
Well, I'd like to thank producer Joel Grove, twiddles the buttons and whips everything into coherence in a...
And executive producer Max Sanderson will have to listen to all of Philippe's stuff.
All right. And the lawyers who will also have to listen to Philippe's stuff or whatever is left of it.
You should have an audio equivalent of the end credits on those American series, which are shown like at incredible speed on the teleprompter. So we would speed up Barry's delivery. We'll end up sounding like what do they call that band? Do you remember that band which did sped up versions of classics? The Chipmunks. Yeah.
The Chipmunks. Were they a band? They sit from America.
Cartoon.
Chipmunks, maybe? Yeah, something like that.
I don't know. Alvin, Simon, Theodore. Anyway, thanks to producer Joel. Thanks to executive producer Max. Thank you to the Chipmunks, Alvin, Simon, and Theodore. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.